Good morning, everyone. Jeffrey Swartz and Brendan Berry here. We're going to be doing the Constitution today for an hour, maybe a little bit more. Unfortunately, Hezzy won't be joining us today, but we all wish him well, and we know that he will be well. So let's all just keep him in our thoughts, and he seems to be doing much better over the last few days. So I'm really happy to announce that he'll be back very shortly to talk to all of you. Brendan and I are both professors of law at WMU Cooley Law School and their Tampa Bay campus. And what we are about to talk about and the opinions that we give are our own opinions. They are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WMU Cooley Law School and or its faculty as a whole. They are solely our own opinions. So let's get started. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How are you?
I'm hanging in there like I always
do.
It's the best function that we have.
Normally
at this time, Brendan and I take a few minutes, sometimes a little bit more than a few minutes, to talk about something that is on our minds. And in particular, we call this, what do you really think? I have this tendency to go after people who I think on a constitutional basis show their ignorance. And today I'm going to go after former Florida Congressman, now Texas Executive Director of the Republican Party, Alan West. First thing I want to say is that there's a term for Alan that we use that came out of Reconstruction, and it's called carpetbagger. And Alan is, without any question, a carpetbagger. He entered the Army at a fairly young age, became a commissioned officer. This is a gentleman who was politely asked to resign his commission following an incident that took place in Iraq in which a captured Iraqi who he and his men believed was an informant and or had information that they wanted and was an intelligence asset was questioned and beaten by Alan's subordinates. When he chose not to speak or said he couldn't speak and didn't know what he was talking about, they were talking about, Alan discharged his firearm right near that particular person's head, at which point the person gave them all kinds of names and made claims of knowing certain things, all of which turned out to be untrue. When the matter was referred to the Army for discipline, rather than court-martialing former Representative West, they chose instead to fine him $5,000 and immediately thereafter then Major West resigned his commission and left the Army, leaving the implication that he was basically told, your career is over, it's time for you to go. And he chose, rather than be discharged, he chose to resign. And that discharge would have had to probably been a general discharge, not an honorable one. So he chose to resign. He then, for some reason or another, chose to go to Florida. He came to Florida and without any political experience at all and spouting a really right-wing, very, very alt-right thought process in his politics, ran for Congress and won a seat. And for 4 years, spouted off unbelievably far right-wing, very militaristic thought processes. He eventually lost his seat after redistricting. And, of course, now being left without anything to do, he moved to Texas, at which point he became a darling of the Texas Republican Party. They made him a member of the Texas military arm. Actually, Texas has a, shall we say, a ceremonial arm, military arm. And eventually, because they liked him so much, they made him the chairman of the Texas Republican Party. Now, being, I guess, the pseudo expert on the Constitution that he claims to be, Alan West decided to claim that Texas could secede from the Union, that they could just take a simple vote in the legislature and announce that they were seceding from the United States of America. Now, first of all, we all know that that was tried once before, and we saw the result of that. Okay, that wasn't working. In fact, Texas was part of that attempt back during the Civil War. They tried to secede from the Union, making the same argument that Alan West is making now. It took until 1870 for Texas to recognize, even though they've been offered to rejoin the Union, it took till 1870 for them to become, to take their place back in the Union. The fact of the matter is the document that Alan West talks about is the declaration or resolution of statehood, in which Texas was granted the right to divide itself into five states if it wanted to, by their own vote, and that all five of those states would then be admitted to the Union. That's what the document agreed they could do. It did not say, as Alan West interprets it, that they could just simply vote to not be a state in the Union. He is a constitutional moron. And he's a right-wing person who's putting out there the type of statements that make it impossible to believe anything that comes out of his mouth, and trying to sell to all of those right-wing Texas Republicans that they have the right to tell the United States of America we're going our own way. Despite their claims that they could survive on their own on oil money, watch how fast all the other technology companies, medical technology companies, all of those people leave the state of Texas because they don't want to leave the Union. They would never survive. Maybe they could become part of Mexico again. I don't know. Okay. But he's just all wrong. And this is typical Alan West in his belligerence and his nonsensical behavior. And it doesn't surprise me that the Texas Republican Party would find him to be such a darling. Alan West travels the country selling this kind of baloney, and it ain't kosher. And Alan West has to learn, or people should learn, that Alan West is somebody that should be tuned out. I'm not canceling him. He can speak all he wants to. But understand what comes out of his mouth is usually 100% wrong. And he's not worth the time and the trouble to listen to. And maybe he wasn't worth the time and the trouble to respond to today. But just to show what an idiot he is, okay? Okay. And that's what I really think about Alan West.
Yeah, that's, well, you know, it's an interesting topic. I often say, you know, when you look at the parts of the country where you most often hear about people wanting to secede from the Union, if those parts of the country did secede from the Union, you might have the world's newest third world country. You're talking about the parts of the country with the worst infant mortality rates, highest levels of poverty, lowest levels of education. And I'm not trying to disparage any particular part of the country. I'm just saying these are not the indicators of a world superpower. But it all comes back to something we talk about pretty much every week, I think, Jeff, which is the completely different way of viewing the world. You know, we have, I think it's most more or less a 60-40 split. You know, where maybe 60% of Americans can be reasoned with. And then there's just a large swath of the population that's going to listen to Alan West, right? No matter what, no matter what you say or I say or anybody else says. So it's interesting, interesting topic. And it's interesting too that I've heard, I don't know if you've heard this from people, but I hear more and more from liberal people, who wonder out loud whether it's time for, I guess you'd call it a national divorce, right? If we've just reached a point where we can't, you know, we're not living in the same space. And I used to only hear that from the right, right? That maybe it's time for a split. But now I actually hear liberal friends talking. Have you ever heard that liberal people musing about that?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Explain to me, please.
Yeah. Well, and I'm not. By the way, I'm not on board with this. But I've some people who I talk to on a regular basis are pretty bright, and very progressive. They don't want to deal with. It's you often hear own the libs, right? Conservatives don't want to deal with the liberals. But I'm starting to hear it from the other way around, right? Where liberals are saying, "Well, we just don't want to deal with conservatives anymore. They're holding the country back. Let them have their own, right?
Well,
give them five states and let them go." Right?
It's like I don't want to deal with you anymore. Let's concentrate it. And by the way, in 20 years after we've done that, we can go to war with each other too.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Okay, that's not working for me, I'm sorry.
No, enemies on the border is not a great idea, but so I don't know, it's all this talk of secession, you know, it's weird to me, you know, why anybody would go there, but again, I'm hearing it pretty regularly, but I wanted to, for my, you know, opening comments here. You know, Jeff, in full disclosure for everybody's listening, Jeff and I had a long conversation this morning before we came on air, and I'm almost all talked out, Jeff, but but one of the things we talked about, this is a touchy subject, but I think it's obviously front and center in the news. But I wanted to focus on one aspect of it that's been striking me. The more I see, you know, these releases of videos, whether it be bystander videos of police conduct during some kind of police interaction, and of course we're talking here about there have been not just the Derek Chauvin trial, but also the police lieutenant who was stopped and. Then Mr. Wright, who was shot by police during a traffic stop. you know, and the video comes out now. Obviously, that's something police have to be acutely aware of. And I've seen in the Chauvin trial, defense lawyer keeps asking expert witnesses and people who are police officers themselves whether they are now you know, whether things have changed, whether it's a whole different dynamic. And this issue of police being recorded, you know, everybody is agreeing that it's a new dynamic, that it's anything that an officer does, especially with body cameras, is going to be recorded. Now, what I've noticed to my, a surprise, I think, when I see a video footage of these interactions is how often, and Jeff, this morning when we were talking, I used a term with you, because, you know, in the latest shooting, of course, what the police chief has said and what the video seems to show is at least the possibility is that a police officer thought she was using a taser when in fact she was holding her service weapon, which she, of course, fired. And the question has come up, you know, how can that kind of thing happen? And a frequent commentator that I hear a lot named Barry McCaffrey, former general, on Twitter, this morning, in response to that question, how can that happen, used the term officer hysteria. And that term, when I read that, that encapsulated what I've been thinking when I watch these videos. I so often want to jump in to the situation I'm looking at and tell the officers, hey, calm down for a minute. There's screaming. Their minds seem to be going a million miles an hour. They're screaming. There's yelling. There's crosstalk. It sounds to me when I'm listening to these interactions like we have police officers who are completely out of control. They're acting on instinct. And the word hysteria is what caught me. So I don't know what's going on with recruiting. I don't know what's going on with training. I don't have any expertise in all of that. But I do know, and someone might ask, what does this have to do with the Constitution? Well, I do know, or I do think, that in a purportedly free country, that is not a quote-unquote police state, that citizens are entitled to interact with authorities in a way that is rational, as calm as possible, and not constantly escalating in the direction of violent conflict. If there was one word, I would want to become a much bigger part of the vocabulary in American life in general, including our political discourse. It would be the word de-escalate. We need to stop with the out-of-control emotional outbursts. And again, it's been the more I see of this kind of footage, the more surprised I am and the more disappointed, obviously, I am to see nobody seems to be trained in de-escalation. Is anybody trained in de-escalation? Why is it the situation is always getting worse?
I happen to agree with that. Let me start here, and that is that when we spoke this morning, I said this, and I truly believe this, that the problem in policing today, when you start talking about officer hysteria, is that many times many of these officers are, over a period of time, I think, lose the edge to a great degree, or create a stronger edge, however you want to put it. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a training issue, and it's a psychological issue. And it's not a training issue as it relates to going to classes over the period of time that they're a police officer, because they should be required to take a lot of continuing education and make it repetitious so and make them actually do it and exercise it in some of this continuing education so they don't lose their edge. But I think that I've said this a couple of times over the last few weeks, that the problem in policing is who we recruit to be police officers, how well we train them, and how well we observe them both during the training process, which is a hiring process, and during the time that they are police officers. I believe that, and I really believe this, there's a reason why when the FBI was first founded, that you had to have a college education to become an FBI agent. If you didn't have a college degree, you couldn't even apply to be an FBI agent. And there's a reason for that. There is a certain amount of education that comes with that. There's a certain amount, in my opinion, of maturity that comes with that education. And I've also felt that this is what's lacking to a great degree within our police departments. And I'm not talking about the officers who are told you have to get some form of education, so they do something online or, you know, some one of these diploma mills, okay, so they can say that they were educated. I think that every police officer in this country should at least have, at minimum, an associate's degree from an accredited full-time college program from a junior college or a community college in criminal justice as a floor, as an absolute floor. And when they decide that they want to be a police officer and they want to go to the academy, I think much stronger psychological testing and interviewing must take place prior to them being even admitted to the academy. I think police academies should be training officers not for 3 or 5 months, not one class in each basic thing that they need to know, but a full year's training, a lot like soldiers have. Over and over and over again, we wonder when we see World War II movies or documentaries, how people could literally throw themselves forward towards people that are firing guns at them. Mm-hmm. And there's a simple answer for that. It's called training. It's called learning what your job is and doing your job. You had mentioned to me in our conversation that police officers have to learn it's not all about them going home at night. It's about everybody going home at night.
Right.
And that it is, as we honor police officers constantly, that every day when they leave, they don't know whether they're coming home. Every day when they leave, they don't know what they're going to see on the street. I absolutely agree with that. But there are things and scenarios and thought processes that people can be trained for by putting them like, not necessarily like the military puts you under a live fire exercise, where you are surrounded by the noise and the confusion of war on an ongoing basis so that you can learn about that and learn how to react appropriately. I describe police officers as being like the guy in the army, in the infantry, who is the point man. Everybody takes a turn being the point man. That's the guy that
right.
walks a distance in front of the rest of the squad or platoon to scout out where you're walking to see things before anybody else sees them. And more times than not, unfortunately, the first guy shot in any kind of ambush is the point man.
Mm-hmm.
And that is unfortunate. And, of course, we honor that person for their bravery. Sometimes people will tell you, I hear people who've been through war tell you that all they wanted to do was stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
First thing I want to do is stay alive. But yet, despite that desire, they do things that will and can, and more times than we'd like to admit, result in the death of that person, which is why we honor those people, because they have a cause. And they obey orders and they do things the way they've been trained. We don't train police officers the way they should be. We don't take them like soldiers off the line for a while, give them R&R, give them more training, and then send them back. Officers go to work every day, and their vacations aren't the same thing. And maybe they need to be taken off the line like an infantryman is every once in a while and given an extended R&R so they can rebuild themselves, refresh themselves, and get out of that angry attitude that you and I talked about that unfortunately mm-hmm. just builds over time so that they think their way through an issue before they get angry over an issue. So, we talked about this, and I happen to agree with you that the issue is who becomes a police officer and how well they're trained to do their jobs and what we do to support them while they are officers. Forget the idea that there's a psychologist available to them if they feel the need for it. They should be required to undergo psychological evaluation on an ongoing basis
mm-hmm.
so we can recognize when people are reaching their limit. You know, like I said, we take soldiers off of the front lines for a period of time And when we first invaded France in World War II, there were soldiers that were, that invaded on D-Day, and they stayed on the line for about a month and a half or 2 months, and they were told, pack your stuff, you're going back to England. And they went back to England for like 2, 3, 4 weeks to get off of the line. And maybe we need to start thinking about that with police officers too. We need to start thinking about the psychology of being a police officer and what it does to someone over a long period of time. Where a guy like, and I'm not excusing, and I'm not using this as an excuse, but a guy like Chauvin, who over a number of years had shown that he was getting closer and closer to the line, to the edge, I mean, take him off the line. Find out what's wrong and deal with it. And if he can't fix it, then give him some sort of discharge and or retirement and tell him you got to go now and make it at least financially possible for him to do that. Police officers, I've known police officers who've worked for 3 or 4 departments over their careers. They get to a point where their pension vests and they move on to another department so they can get another pension that vests. So they can go to another department to a pension vest, and that's where they move. Now, maybe those moves make it possible for them to get off the line for a while. But the bottom line is I think that's what we have to do for our police officers today. And I think it would make our policing that much better.
Yeah. It's also, you know, I had had an uncle who was a police officer. He's now deceased. But he was actually a police officer in New York in Nassau County on Long Island. And I remember talking to him and talking to others, and I'm sure you've heard this, and this is another thing that's kind of shocking to me. You know, you used to hear veteran police officers, you know, or retired police officers saying, you know, I went through my entire career and never drew my weapon. That was just a common experience that, I remember my uncle telling me that, he had never drawn his weapon, on somebody in his entire career. And now you watch these videos again, it seems like their instinct is to, right? the weapons are, I don't know about you, Jeff, but I do not want to be on the wrong end. Right, of a loaded pistol. That would terrify me because I've been stopped for a traffic violation or anything else for that matter. But you know, this and obviously this has to do also with the proliferation of guns. Right, I mean when my uncle was patrolling the streets of Nassau County, there were not more guns than people in the United States. And he didn't face the same fears, right, that police officers do today. You know, there was obviously the possibility, right, that anybody that he stopped could be a bad actor and could have a weapon. But it wasn't anywhere near as likely as it is now. I talk all the time about the militarization of police, but I think that has a lot to do with the proliferation of guns, which is yet another issue, constitutional issue, right, that we can't seem to grapple with as a country and come to some kind of rational place, you know, which, you know, which of course brings
And we'll get to that. Yeah, I mean, I want to say this. You used the term police hysteria that General McCafferty used. And I think that is, and when I went to the training issue, I think that was part of what I wanted to talk about, is the idea that they should be put through these live scenarios over and over and over again, okay, so that they don't want to draw their weapon first. And so that they know how to deal with de-escalating and the idea of not drawing their weapon, because there are those police officers who the first time they draw their weapon actually go through that hysteria. My gun is in my hand. Now what do I do? okay? And I think to a certain extent, and I'm not excusing away what happened in the Knight case, but I have to look at it and say to myself, based upon what I've read of this particular police officer's history with this department, her 26-year history with this department, it appears that she has been recognized for doing the right thing every single time. Whether it was a shooting that took place a couple years ago, she was the first officer on the scene, and the first thing she does is tell the two police officers that were involved in it, you get in your car, you get in your car, turn off your cameras, and don't talk to anybody. And don't talk to each other, so that when they got interviewed, they were pristine.
Mm-hmm.
She was a police negotiator. She was the head of the union for a while. And it may well be, we may find out, this is the first time she's ever had to draw a weapon on anybody. And then the excitement did not, and there is an article in the New York Times today that talks about just this, that this is not the first time, and it happens more time than people know, that someone draws the wrong weapon. The design of the two weapons is almost identical between a Glock 17 and the taser that was used in this particular instance. And there are a number of times that officers have driven or drawn the wrong weapon. And let me say this right now. This does not excuse away that type of negligence. And she may face culpable negligence and manslaughter charges. There's no question about that. Okay? And in today's atmosphere, it's more likely than not that she will. But that the bottom line is that a training issue? Is that putting her through the kind of training it takes, live training, unexpected events taking place, people being belligerent with her, not knowing that that's what's going to occur, saying, okay, we're going to do the perfect traffic stop, and then the guy turns on her or the woman turns on her, so that she's trained to recognize what that's all about. Those are the kind of things that need to take place. And if you're going to really train, it has to be constant. It can't be, okay, you're okay, go out on the street. No. You go out on the street, but you're constantly still being trained how to deal with those situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it sounds militaristic, and the idea of a militaristic society and policing bothers a lot of people. But the bottom line, and that may be part of the problem too. We're taking too many people out of the military and making them police officers, because they've been in combat. So all of a sudden now they're ready to deal with domestic combat. I'm not so sure.
Yeah.
So a lot has to happen.
Yeah. And also, a lot of police forces get surplus equipment when the military is not using. And, you can't blame police officers for wanting that equipment when they're facing assault weapons,
right?
I mean, they're out. So,
yeah,
it is.
Police officers,
that's part of the problem, too.
Police officers are outgunned. In many cases, police officers are outgunned.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
We know that. Okay? Don't go to a gunfight with a pistol when the other guy's got an AR-15.
Right.
And the guy who recently got shot, the police officer who recently died, rushing into the public supermarket. Was it a public supermarket? No, it was in Colorado. Okay?
Yeah, right.
In the Colorado shooting, okay? He was outgunned. The minute he walked in there, he knew he was outgunned.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
But he did what he had to do. So we'll leave it at that. There's a lot more to talk about in this event, but let's just sort of leave it at that. And let's get into some of the recent activity of the Supreme Court, which I think we need to talk about.
Yeah.
The easy and the first one is the recent decision by the Supreme Court to not review and let stand a blocking of the California COVID restriction on religious activities. And just to set the stage for everyone, the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 vote, blocked another COVID-19 restriction on religious services with a late night order. They tend to do these things late at night. And this was over protests of California officials that limits affecting some Bible study sessions did not impinge on religious rights and were to be lifted within days. This unsigned order, and when we say unsigned, we mean an order which is not authored by anybody nor signed by any particular justice. It's just issued by the clerk on the order of the court, revealed a deep ideological problem and fissure with conservatives. And that includes all three of the appointed Trump justices in control, who are now in control, and the liberals who dissent bitterly on these situations. Justice Roberts, by the way, was part of the dissent.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't sign, okay, and refused to sign the statement, although he did not sign the statement that was issued by the three justices on the left, written by Justice Kagan. So let's talk about what's behind all of this and what they were talking about. And I think you got a better grasp of this than I do, so go to it.
Yeah, it's an interesting case, and it's part of a series of cases where the court is moving in a different direction. It's there's an old case called called Smith, Employment Division versus Smith, that was of all people written by Justice Scalia, and the issue in that case was somebody who was arrested for using peyote, which was an illegal drug in that state. They claimed, and they were sincere about it, that the use of the peyote was part of a religious ceremony. And so therefore, the state punishing somebody for a religious practice violated the free exercise clause, right? So the First Amendment has a clause in it that says that the government may not interfere with the free exercise of religion. And what Justice Scalia said was, look, exercising religion or your freedom to exercise your religion does not excuse you from compliance with what he called generally applicable laws, right? The laws that they don't target religion, they don't target faith, they don't target any particular belief. They're laws passed under state, you know, a police power, right? Health, safety, general welfare of the population. That there are no exceptions, right? Everybody has to follow the same rules. If there's nothing about, this is what Justice Scalia talking, if there's, for the court, if there's nothing about a law that indicates targeting of religion, then there is no free exercise claim. There's a reason why courts used to be that kind of careful about free exercise claims. If the court were to say that anybody is excused from complying with a law that offends that person's religious beliefs or sensibilities, then the next time I got stopped for speeding, right, I would roll down the window and tell the police officer, I believe that I have to go 90 miles per hour to commune with the Almighty, so get away from me, right? This is a religious exercise, right?
Or at least get
you know
to
you. Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, right. But, you know, or you know, so, you know, the next time, well, May 17th is the tax deadline, I would just send a note that says, I'm sorry, but paying taxes is against my religion. So that thinking has always been in the minds of judges. You can't accommodate everybody's claimed religious beliefs, you know, whenever they conflict with a generally applicable law. Now, the direction the court's going is to abandon that. The court has never expressly overruled Smith, but there have now been a series of cases where and this includes cases like the Hobby Lobby case, right, where an employer said I shouldn't have to provide insurance coverage to my employees, right, that covers contraception. There's obviously a law that says that you have to provide insurance coverage to your employees, and that insurance coverage has to include reproductive health, has absolutely nothing to do with religion. Nonetheless, so it's a generally applicable law. It applies the same way to everybody. nonetheless, the court said, well, no, you have to accommodate the religious beliefs of these employers. And that's what's going on now. The California law, what California argued was, this law, it applies to all gatherings, right, in the home. That's they're pretty intricate rules about how many people can gather from how many households, right, depending on, you know, who's been vaccinated and all that kind of thing. Those rules applied to all gatherings. But obviously the people who challenged the rule were people who wanted to have, as you called it, Bible study, right? They wanted to have gatherings of so many people in private homes for those purposes, for religious purposes. And the court found that, in fact, apparently they found, because they actually gave a brief explanation, which was nice, because in a lot of these cases, as you say, we call this the shadow docket, right, where the court late at night, right, issues these unsigned orders that actually change doctrine without even explaining their reasoning. So the court has come under fire lately for doing this far too often. But this time, at least they wrote a couple paragraphs to try to explain it. But they were nonsensical. The five justices in the majority said, well, you know, you can go to liquor stores and you can, you know, there are certain businesses that are open, so you shouldn't be treating these gatherings any differently. Justice Gorsuch said that in a concurring opinion in another one of these cases, where he said, you can't, if you can go to the liquor store, you can go to church. And apparently he's unable. Well, first of all, they've decided that they are public health experts, right? So they've waded into this territory. But when I read that, Jeff, how much time do we spend talking to students about analogical reasoning, all right? Comparing and distinguishing, right? And
right.
If you can't distinguish between a religious service where there's a large gathering of people indoors for hours at a time, engaging in song and collective prayer and things like that. If you can't distinguish between that and a 5-minute trip to the liquor store, you know, you got a problem. There's
that,
a
that
reason
was,
why.
That was that was really the basis, one of the major bases of Justice Kagan's dissent in this particular instance. When basically she just said, you know, that there's a difference that the lower court had found when people gather in social settings, the interactions, according to the court,
right,
and at least according to what we know socially, tend to be longer than in commercial
right.
settings and involved prolonged conversations. Okay.
Right.
What these two people were complaining about, Jeremy Wong and Karen Bush, they were pastors who were arguing that this was an interruption with their free exercise rights by preventing their usual Bible studies and prayer sessions with 8 to 12 individuals, which obviously people from different homes, different places, not doing a commercial thing where you walk in and I buy, oh, I need a rotisserie chicken, thank you, here's your $5, and out the door you go, okay?
Right.
As you put it, prolonged conversation, as she put it. And the fact that, and this is where she closed, I really love this, she wrote, because the majority continues to disregard law and facts alike, I respectfully dissent. And very Scalia-ish, by the way. But Okay. I just made some sort of adverb out of right. Out of Justice Scalia, but it really is very Scalia-ish what she wrote, and it really was to me a very political decision, which is probably why Thomas did not go along with it. That this was a social decision, not a legal one, and not a particularly well-reasoned one, but it lived up to their own political thought processes as opposed to dealing with society as it is today and the problems that we're coming with, which, of course, leads us to one of the last thing we're going to talk about today, and that is the First Amendment issue involving one of our favorite talk show hosts, Alex Jones, because we all love him so, especially the people in Newtown. They just love him to death, literally.
Right.
And so as a result of which, let's start talking about the opinion that just came down on Mr. Jones's case. And more surprisingly, we'll end up talking about Justice Thomas's dissent, which was rather surprising for a man who has a hard time putting two words together when he's on the bench, but seemed to manage write an opinion which just sort of opened everything he thought about the court and its powers in a very off the wall dissent. So let's talk about the Alex Jones case and what happened here.
Good. Yep.
Essentially, Mr. Jones was sued for defamation for making allegations after the Sandy Hook Elementary School situation, the killing of all these children, in which he said that it was all fake, that emails had been planted to make the shooter and other people look worse than they were, and making allegations that the parents never lost any children, that this was all just pretend, and that it never happened, and accused the parents of perpetuating a fraud, all for the idea of removing people's Second Amendment rights. The case was scheduled to go to trial, and there were some discovery issues. In particular, in this case, it dealt with emails and other communications received by or sent by Mr. Jones to other people. And his claim that he had a First Amendment right to say whatever he wanted to say, and let's face one reality from the start. The First Amendment does protect, with some limited exceptions, your ability to say horrendous and despicable things without fear that the government will silence that speech. But in this particular case, not so much. So apparently, certain sanctions were issued against Mr. Jones for failing to disclose all of this information, claiming he had a First Amendment right. Jones brought up two exceptions to the First Amendment, that we do allow people to be punished for speech when that speech is defamatory or exposes an imminent threat of physical harm, both of which happened when Mr. Jones made claims on air that Sandy Hook shootings, that 26 people died, 20 of whom were children, were staged, and that everybody was a paid actor. So let's talk about, as you've talked about before, what it takes for something to be defamatory. What are the elements of defamation? Brendan?
You want me to answer that?
Yeah, I want you to answer that. I do want you to answer.
All right. Well, defamation, right. I mean, and the broader point you make is important, too. There are oftentimes you hear people, again, on the extremes of the political spectrum, talking as though constitutional guarantees are absolutes. And as we know, there is no such thing as an absolute, right? there are judges constantly say constitutional guarantees, especially individual rights, are to be interpreted in a way that is reasonable, right? That the Constitution is not a suicide pact. The Second Amendment is not an absolute, and neither is the First. People have heard, of course, the common refrain, right? You're not allowed to shout fire in a crowded theater, right, if there isn't one. There are exceptions to free speech, and defamation is one of them. Incitement is another, right? You're not allowed to incite imminent lawless activity. Obscenity is another exception. Right, there you go. Good. Well done. Thank you for demonstrating the point. First of all, the people Alex Jones was defaming, right, were these parents, they're not public figures. Again, as we teach in law school, there are different rules, right, in different types of defamation cases. If the person you are allegedly defaming is a public figure, then you would have to show actual malice, right? The point being, if I'm a public figure, I have to take, I have to take the things that people are going to say about me, but that comes with the territory. So if I'm a famous actor or I asked for it, right? So on the other hand, these are just regular private citizens who are going about their lives when tragedy befell them. So they are not public right. figures. What you need for defamation is a lie, first of all, right? Something untruthful. It mm-hmm. has to be obviously damaging, right? There has to be an injury caused by which could be psychological or otherwise, but there has to be some kind of damage caused by it. There has to be what we call publication, right? That it was, and that doesn't mean literally in a newspaper. It means that it was put out there in the public domain somehow. Then the question is, what's the state of mind, right? Was the person negligent or reckless? Did the person either know that what he was saying was untruthful, or did he say something that a reasonable person should have known was untruthful?
Right.
Those are the things. Those are the things that you have to show if you want to win a defamation lawsuit against somebody, and you're a private person and not a public figure.
Right.
And so obviously this was a good. These were good facts for the plaintiffs.
Yeah. What happened here in particular, so that people would understand, during the trial proceedings on the initial claim, Mr. Jones, who was continuing to rant on his show, I don't know how he does it day after day. He actually needs, maybe to be taken off the line for a while. Mr. Jones claimed on his show that one of the lawyers representing the Sandy Hook family planted child pornography in email data that he had to turn over as part of the suit. Jones didn't stop there. He mentioned the lawyer by name, pointed to a photograph of him, and said, and remember, Mr. Jones' show is not only on the radio, it's syndicated, and said,
right.
$1 million to put your head on a pike, and I'm going to kill... And then he stopped and said, anyway, I'm done. Total war. You want it, you got it. The trial court had some real problems with that and sanctioned Jones for failing to turn over the documents to the lawyers representing the Sandy Hook families. That was his excuse for not turning over the documents, claiming that child pornography had been planted in them. Well, if there's
right.
child pornography in there, I wouldn't want to turn
right.
them over either. Okay, but don't blame it on somebody else. When Jones claimed that the judge's sanctions violated his First Amendment rights, a unanimous Supreme Court in Connecticut disagreed.
Yeah.
And they said there's another exception to the First Amendment to them speech that is imminent and likely to threat as a threat to the administration of justice. And Jones appealed it. And, of course, the court drew a line at this and basically dismissed Mr. Jones's appeal. That was one case. The other case was a matter of justice, not so much the majority opinion, but a dissenting opinion written by Justice Thomas, which was used, which was basically, in most people who observe it, a real overstep of his authority in what justices do. He took on big tech, where big tech was not the issue. He weighed in on a matter of public policy, which justices don't do, and tried to put some pressure of his own in the midst of a social political dispute, and even floated legislative ideas on how Congress could restrain big tech. This, by the way, in the case, he said that he wrote to and basically issued an opinion not just about the merits of the case itself, but about big tech censorship more broadly. He suggested that legislatures could limit the freedom of tech companies to block or ban people from their sites. This was the dissent in the Trump Twitter case, mm-hmm. the power of him to be able to block people on his Twitter account. And in other words, he wrote to suggest ways in which the government could override the liberty of private citizens to manage and moderate speech on their own private platforms.
Right.
Now, this is kind of surprising because he had been on the other side of other issues like this. For example, the First Amendment comes into play here because in a long line of precedent featuring, you know, rulings by justices basically on both sides of the ideological aisle, the private corporations possess their own free speech rights. And I
right.
can point to Citizens United as one of being the most important.
Mm-hmm.
Although Senator McConnell has his feelings about that, that, you know, right. I want your money, but keep your mouth shut. Okay.
Right.
It pointed to your aforementioned Hobby Lobby case, in which they resisted contraceptive mandates because it interfered with religious freedom. Newspaper
right.
articles basically are corporate free speech. Union endorsements are corporate free speech. So are church statements of faith, party platforms. So the idea that social media moderation decisions are not their exercise of their mm-hmm. free speech on their platform somehow offended Thomas.
Right.
Which is absurd. And what he proposes just bothers the hell out of many constitutional experts. And this is something that justices should not be doing.
Right.
If I'm a tech company and I'm coming in front of him, I want him on my bench defending me before this. Now if I'm a tech company
right.
and I'm arguing, okay, against the right to restrict my platform, I don't want him on my side.
Right.
I want you to go away. Okay, go away, disqualify yourself, because you already told me how you're going to rule. You're already on mm-hmm. the other side.
Right. Right.
He argued it in a way that it was some sort of interference with private concentrated control over online content, quote unquote. but there people have argued that this is like FedEx and AT&T somehow because they have all of this power. But to compare, as one person wrote, to compare phone service and package delivery to social media is to try to jam a square peg into a round hole.
Right.
Okay?
Right. Right.
Facebook is moderated. It has been moderated since day one.
Right.
And it will continue to be moderated. Thomas has repeatedly protected corporate free speech. But Facebook Corporation doesn't have the right
mm-hmm.
to limit what people say on its site. Or
right.
Twitter doesn't have the right,
right.
to say who says what on their site.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a completely, completely different thing.
It is. And it does fly in the face of Supreme Court precedent as well. I mean, the Supreme Court has repeatedly held that the right to free speech includes the right not to associate yourself with ideas or language that you find offensive. That's the same reason you can't force a student to recite a pledge against their will. You can't. There was one famous case called Woolley out of New Hampshire, where police kept stopping somebody. The state motto in New Hampshire is "Live free or die." And this particular individual decided he did not agree with that. He thought he would rather live under a tyranny, right, than die. So it offended his belief system, and he would tape over that state motto on his license plate, and he kept getting pulled over. And the Supreme Court said he does not have to drive around with that motto on his license plate if he doesn't want to.
Right.
The right to free speech includes the right not to say something you don't want to say, not to participate in expressing an idea, right, that you don't want to be associated with. So if a private company says, we do not want to be associated with conspiracy theories and misinformation, right, and medical misinformation, public health misinformation, that's going to lead people to we make our choice as a private entity not to associate ourselves with that information or those messages. They have an absolute First Amendment right to do that.
Right.
And thus,
the All-Star game is being played in Denver, not Atlanta.
That's right. Exactly.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Thus,
Delta can find another city with a big enough airport to be its hub in the South. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
need to be in Atlanta.
Right.
Okay. Thus, Coca-Cola can say we're moving our corporate headquarters. Or companies move all the time because they don't like the political situation that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
How many companies, for example, don't move to a particular place because they don't have the schools? Their employees don't want to go there because the schools are horrible.
Right.
That's a political statement, isn't it?
Right.
A public policy statement, make your schools better, or we're not bringing our company here, we're not bringing our business there. Companies do that all the time. The fact that
mm-hmm.
some are more public and more known, or some of them are really shouting at the wind, okay, doesn't mean that they're any less the same thing.
Right.
And so therefore, you know, company and that's hard for me to argue because that's arguing in favor of Citizens United. Okay. And that, you know, you get caught in that by saying, I agree with Citizens United. I agree
mm-hmm.
with the premise that corporations are people.
Right.
But just like we limit people making contributions, we should limit corporations from making contributions.
Right.
Okay. Of course, Mitch McConnell says, keep your mouth shut, don't do anything public, don't talk about policy, just give us our money.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that
worked. I thought that was really a brilliant statement. I mean, Mitch, you know, you're not an off-the-cuff speaker. Don't even think you are, okay?
Right,
don't say anything
yeah.
that isn't pre-planned. Got it? Okay? Okay? All right? It's just not so. So, all right, we've reached our hour.
Yeah.
And I think it's time for us to sign off. We never did get to Chauvin. We never really got into the Nazario and the Knights cases.
Yeah, there's always next week.
I think that we should get into it. There is next week. Next week, Chauvin will be in his closing arguments. Closing arguments should start sometime next week, even by Tuesday or Wednesday. So we'll have a clear picture of where the evidence stands at that point and what the legal issues, at least what does remain. By the way, I just want to throw this in. I don't think that the judge handled what was happening in Minnesota and what happened in Virginia very well with this jury. And I think he may have, in fact, created the error that may end up in a reversal of this. There should have been some inquiry made of the jury due to the new information and what information they had. And he did not do that. And so I think that he has now created, he was afraid he was going to get answers he didn't want to hear that would have caused a mistrial. So he just didn't go there in hopes that an appellate court will uphold him on this one. I got a feeling that they got the error they needed.
Yeah. And you're talking about his decision not to sequester the jury, right?
Yeah, and in the process, not even question them.
Right.
Okay, to find out if they knew what was going on and whether it affected them or did they live in the area or any of those things after the night shooting and the dealing with Nazario, with Lieutenant Nazario. So I have a feeling that the error may be there, but we can discuss that more next week when we see what happens. You know, there just wasn't anything done by this judge, and I think the hands-off thought process was the wrong process. And it does create an issue, probably the best appellate issue we've gotten so far, other than maybe allowing certain people to testify that should not have been allowed to testify. We'll see. That could probably be declared to be harmless under the circumstances. But this is not harmless by any stretch of the imagination. So we'll talk about that next week. Hopefully we'll have more to talk about there.
Indeed.
Brendan, have yourself a wonderful day.
You do as well. Stay safe, and we'll be talking soon.
You too. Okay, you all take right. care. Everybody have a wonderful day. Everybody stay safe yourselves, and we'll hopefully you'll hear from us soon next week. Okay? Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.